Hello, Red Journal podcast listeners. Sue Yom here, welcoming you to the new year, 2026. We had a nice article publishing in this issue that I thought was very instructive for both our readers and our authors. This is called Red Journal Reviews, Typology, Methodology, and Standards. We are lucky to have the first and last author here with us today to walk us through the article. First, welcome to Dr. Justin Smith, a registrar in Queensland, Australia. Hi, Dr. Smith.
Hi, Dr. Yom. Thanks so much for having us. We're really pleased the journal chose to highlight this work, and we're excited to talk through what we found.
And we also welcome Dr. Lachlan McDowell here to the podcast. He's an attending radiation oncologist at Princess Alexandra Hospital in Brisbane, Australia, and serves as our section editor for Head and Neck Cancer at the Journal. Welcome, Dr. McDowell.
Thanks, Dr. Yom. It's really great to be back here at the Red Journal podcast, and I'm really thrilled that you chose to highlight this article. Really looking forward to fruitful and interesting conversation that I hope really resonates with prospective authors out there and also our valued reviewers.
Dr. Smith, let's get the conversation started. So tell me a little bit about why you and Dr. McDowell wanted to put this research together.
So for me, this came from my experience as a trainee with my experiences as an author and a reviewer. One of the first major projects was a critical review on carotid artery stenosis that Dr. McDowell and I submitted to the Red Journal. I remember getting the reviewer comments that clearly reflected different expectations for the type of review that we were actually doing. Some were asking for elements you'd expect in a full systematic review, while others were thinking of it more as a narrative or critical piece. And this experience to me made me realize that I wasn't completely sure myself where the boundaries were and what distinguished a narrative, critical, or systematic review, and what level of methodological detail is required for each. When I went back to the literature to try to clarify it for my own submission, I found there were some great typologies out there, but these weren't really translated into everyday language for radiation oncology. At the same time, I just come through the Red Journal Reviewer Training Program, which really sparked my interest in how to do a high-quality constructive review. I wanted to be giving authors feedback that I thought was both fair and appropriate for the kind of review that they'd set out to do. So I guess this project grew out of those personal experiences, and we wanted to give colleagues, especially other trainees, a simple and practical map of the different review types and to look honestly at what had been done in the Red Journal over the last decade. We then hoped to create a guide for authors, reviewers, and editors to make the submission and review process more straightforward and not just a rigid rule book. And I really want to emphasize as well that this was very much a team effort with yourself, Dr. Scher, Dr. McDowell, and my fellow trainee co-authors, Dr. Dickstein and Dr. Mitter, who really drove a lot of the classification and data extraction.
Dr. Smith, I'm so excited to hear that your experiences in REPERT, our resident training program, played into this. Would you mind sharing a little bit about how your experience was in REPERT? I think a lot of residents are still not aware of that program, and it's something that the Red Journal holds really near and dear.
Thanks, Dr. Dom. I certainly enjoyed my time as part of the trainee reviewer program, and I found that it was a really great way to be able to build confidence in how to construct a review. The editors at the Red Journal were very helpful in providing feedback on the reviews that I submitted, and I found that's really enhanced my confidence to be able to put together a high-quality review into the future.
Dr. McDowell, do you want to comment on your motivation for being part of the project?
Thanks, Dr. Yom. From my side, as an editor, I was seeing some of the same issues, but from a slightly different angle. Over the years that I've been involved on the editorial board, there's obviously a bit of blurring around the edges in how reviews are written by authors and how they're evaluated by reviewers. And I'd see that we'd receive really interesting and thoughtful review submissions, but sometimes the methods and the expectations weren't quite aligned with the type of review that was intended or submitted. On the flip side, I'd also see reviewers with the best of intentions asking for elements that weren't required for the type of review that was in front of them. And this can become a barrier to acceptance for what was potentially a really great paper for our section, or create a lot of extra work for authors without necessarily improving the paper. And I think in the current climate, we're all looking to not unnecessarily burden both reviewers and authors with necessary work. And I've certainly had that experience myself, both as an author, with both reviewers of my papers and also co-authors on my papers asking me to do features that didn't necessarily fit in with the review's purpose. So the motivation was both personal and service oriented. Personally, I wanted to outline a more consistent and fair structure in what we were asking of authors at the Red Journal. And more broadly, this will help to support the community, the wider community, authors, reviewers, and readers by clarifying the landscape. I also think it was quite important for the Red Journal to outline what their specific expectations for authors, reviewers, and editors. And this was our attempt to step back and say, well, this is, as the premier global radiation oncology journal, what do we want in terms of reviews? What are our expectations? And ultimately, the goal was to try and help people think about the most appropriate review type for their specific question and feel confident that when they're submitting their journal, it's on a solid footing because it's met those expectations for that specific review type.
I totally agree with that. We actually have had authors who tried to write review articles for us of various types. And as you state, both of you didn't really understand the format that they were aiming for. And that confusion came out in the article and in the review process. And we tried to, in some cases, encourage authors to submit a pre-submission inquiry with an outline of the review. But sometimes that even is not quite enough to really provide enough feedback or direction. So I really think this is a great article to just kind of get everyone on the same page and hopefully provide education for the entirety of the radiation oncology community about what different formats of reviews should or should not be trying to do. And so to go on with what we actually did in the article, Dr. Smith, as a major part of the article, your team, as you were describing, classified all the different review articles over the past 10 years from 2014 to 2024, which were published in our journal, the Red Journal. Could you walk us through the classifications that you developed out of that process and tell us a little bit about how these review types differ from one another?
So again, I'd like to acknowledge our co-authors, Dr. Mitter and Dr. Dickstein, who assisted immensely in collecting this data. The most common types of reviews that we found, at least in the Red Journal, were firstly systematic reviews or systematic reviews and meta-analyses or critical or narrative reviews. There were also less common types of reviews, which included descriptive, bibliometric and umbrella reviews. So at one end are the more data aggregation reviews, like systematic reviews, which may or may not include a formal meta-analysis. These are designed to answer a focused clinical or research question, usually with PRISMA-style methods, a clearly defined methodology and a structured search with predefined inclusion criteria, and a formal quality or risk of bias assessment. If the data are reasonably compatible, you might then add a meta-analysis to pool effect estimates. It's also considered best practice to prospectively register these systematic reviews on a platform like Prospero or OSF. And then we have scoping reviews, which look quite similar on the surface. They also use structured searches and the PRISMA guidelines, but the goal is different. They are about mapping the breadth of a field, identifying what has been studied and where the gaps are, rather than producing a single pooled estimate to change practice immediately. These tend to not include a formal quality appraisal of the included articles. We then considered narrative and critical reviews with existing information on a particular topic. Both of these are qualitative synthesis that, when well executed, can be highly influential. A narrative review is principally descriptive. It maps the existing landscape and answers, in essence, what is out there. A critical review goes further by appraising the strengths and limitations of the evidence, reconciling conflicting findings, and articulating priorities for future research. Neither format technically requires the inclusion of a formal search strategy or quality assessment, although these can be incorporated if they add clarity or credibility to the review. This methodological latitude gives authors flexibility in how they structure and present their work without the obligation to exhaustively catalogue every publication on a topic. However, authors should take care not to introduce bias by omitting studies that do not support their own argument. And in fact, a more compelling and balanced review is often achieved by deliberately including such studies and thoughtfully exploring differences in how the methodology or outcomes can explain the divergent results. And finally, I just want to highlight that there are some less common types that are underused in radiation oncology, or at least there have only been a few of these published in the Red Journal over the last decade. Firstly, these are descriptive reviews which look at patterns in study design, outcomes, or methodologies. We then found some bibliometric reviews, which map authors, institution, and citation networks, but also evaluate the broader impact of research on the system. And this is often used in aspects like funding or policy. And then finally, there's umbrella reviews, which systematically review other systematic reviews. And we just want to highlight that in reality, there is some blurring at the edges. So the message that we wanted to convey is that not that people are wrong, but that being intentional and matching a review type to your aim and being transparent about it really helps readers, reviewers, and editors.
So just to add to the excellent overview that Dr. Smith has provided, there within the spectrum of bibliometric reviews, that may also include a citometric review. And that's in contrast to the bibliometric reviews, which map authors, institution and citation networks. It's actually the citometric reviews, which sort of focus more broadly on how that research is influencing the science system. So on aspects, say, like funding or policy.
And Dr. McDowell, I think a question that might come up from some readers is, what's the difference between one of these reviews versus what we often see in literature, which is systematic review and meta-analysis, or alternatively, what some people call white papers?
That's a great question, Dr. Yom, and there are some blurring between these different types of reviews. A meta-analysis is really, in contrast to some of the other reviews, is really about aggregating the data that's already out there and pooling those to, I guess, quantitatively assess the impact of a treatment or other intervention or outcome versus a white paper, which is really not an exhaustive literature review. And that's really more a position or policy statement or from professional organizations on a particular matter, but doesn't require necessarily a full systematic review of the literature.
Thank you so much, Dr. McDowell. That's very illuminating. And Dr. Smith, maybe you could tell us then, what were the major findings from the classification exercise? I think you actually were able to specify which sections of the Red Journal had published the most reviews of different types and how much they were cited, which is all interesting.
There are a few things that really stood out to us. So firstly was that critical reviews were the main form of review that were published in the Red Journal within this 10-year period. And this comprised 56% of the 258 reviews that were published. The next most prevalent was systematic reviews, which comprised 42% of the reviews. It was interesting to find there were only four reviews across all other types of reviews combined. So over this entire decade, the Red Journal published only one scoping review, one descriptive review, and two bibliometric reviews. And this really showed just how dominant narrative or critical reviews and systematic review formats have been in the Red Journal, and how we as a community have tended to work and publish within a fairly narrow set of review types. What we didn't have access to was whether there had been more of these types of reviews submitted, but ultimately didn't pass through to publication. Another interesting finding was that many reviews didn't specifically specify their type. So we found that about 42% of all the reviews didn't clearly identify what type of review they set out to do. Even systematic reviews didn't always meet the methodological expectations. We found that only 46% of these systematic reviews performed a risk of bias assessment, as is recommended in the PRISMA guidelines. And I think that we want to be clear here that we shouldn't interpret this as a criticism, but more as a chance to be clearer and more consistent with review methodologies and the Red Journal expectations going forward, particularly now that we've tried to lay out the review menu and expectations in one place. The most common topics of these reviews were biology, which was 12%, pediatrics, which was 11%, and then genitourinary, which was 9%. In terms of citation outcomes, we found that the critical reviews were very well cited, with a median citation count of 27.5, followed by systematic reviews, which had a median citation count of 15.5. Both of these were very right-skewed distributions, though, with a small number of very highly cited papers. We also found that the sections with the highest median citations were physics with a median of 48, lung with a median of 44, and head and neck with a median of 31.
That actually jibes really well with my overall impression of things. And I would say, just in reaction to the pediatric prevalence that might have been due to the publication of PenTech, where we published essentially an entire volume of reviews of various kinds. And the other thing I would ask about Dr. Smith, did you see any trend over time that the reviews were more consistently meeting a certain typology? I wonder if this has sort of been a process of education as people have read more and more of these types of reviews and become more accustomed to the format over the past decade.
We didn't specifically report whether the compliance with the expectations was increasing with time. It's something that we certainly could look at, but I think from looking through them, we did see that there was a trend most likely towards there being a bit better in the more recent publications. But it certainly would be interesting to look at in more detail.
Dr. McDowell, what's your impression of that? And then the other question I have, as you're an accomplished author and editor yourself, is why do you think some of these other review types aren't being used at the Red Journal, and why wouldn't you use them or use them?
I mean, I think to add to the citation comment, I mean, I was quite surprised by the median citation count that we saw. And I think just when we look, we included the reviews that had occurred or been published very recently. But when you go back and have a look at what was published before 2020, I mean, the median citation count across all of those reviews was 50 for the critical and narrative reviews and 55 for the systematic reviews. So these really well-written reviews in the Red Journal are really being very well cited across the literature. And I think that's it was a really important, and I was a little surprised by the numbers, but I think that was a really interesting finding. In terms of why some of these other review types are not well known, I think this is probably comes down to history and how we're trained. For many of us, we basically wrote a narrative or critical review, or we wrote a systematic review and maybe a meta-analysis. I think also historically, the review section of the Red Journal has been was called a critical review. While we, as editors, were assessing more broadly the whole range of reviews available to us, I'm not sure whether that may have influenced the types of submissions that we were receiving. And I guess we're the as a medical field, we're very familiar with quantitative type analyses that we would see in systematic reviews with meta-analyses. The types of reviews like scoping, descriptive, bibliometric, or umbrella reviews, I think they've really emerged from other research communities, and they just haven't been part of our standard toolkit in radiation oncology. The other aspect I think of that is the bibliometric and scintometric reviews. I mean, I think they're only becoming more accessible to the community as the software and hardware capabilities are increasing. And I think just to highlight Dr. Smith's other point is that we weren't able to access what reviews had been submitted over this time and possibly had not made it through peer review. We were only able to assess those ones which went through to successful publication. And I guess there is the possibility that these other types of reviews, which editors and reviewers may not be familiar with, that they may not have resonated well through the peer review process. So I am hopeful that this article, providing a broader set of review article types, may legitimize those options and encourage authors to consider whether some of these less familiar types of reviews might suit relevant questions to radiation oncology.
Yeah, I agree. I think it can be a little bit self-reinforcing because, for instance, I noticed during some of our review processes that people were being asked to use the PRISMA standards when really it wasn't intended to be a systematic review. And that other, as you state, Dr. McDowell, that certain types of reviews, like various other of these categories, were criticized for not being critical or systematic review. So I do think that it's a little bit of a self-reinforcing process in that we started publishing certain types and then those types get read and those types are the ones that everyone knows and is familiar with and expects to see. And then we just get more of those established types. So just a very interesting sort of process to track over the past decade. And so Dr. McDowell, to continue with you on some of this topic that we're addressing here a little bit, What are the major pitfalls if a researcher wants to write a review? Is there anything you learned out of this process that you could advise? What are the common mistakes that could be avoided at the beginning or during the process? And that will also help those of us who read reviews to understand when we're seeing a potential weakness.
I think the first thing I want to say is that I think we've all been guilty of missing the mark with review articles at some point in our academic journey. So the purpose of this piece is not, it really comes from a place of personal growth and understanding rather than just trying to criticize what's already been done. I think one of the common early traps is a mismatch between the question and the review type. We see that someone might be exploring a broad emerging field, for instance, like AI and radiation oncology, but they will label the paper as a systematic review without really sort of having an understanding of the homogeneity that exists in what's been published out there, and which really doesn't lend itself well to a systematic review. Other types of reviews, like scoping reviews or even bibliometric reviews, as to where that data is coming from, that could be very informative for our field. But other times, people feel obliged to do a full systematic review when a well-argued critical review or even a scoping review might be a better fit and actually might be more insightful in moving our field forward and shaping the direction of future research. I think it's really important to define the question up front and really be very clear about which review article is going to, or review methodology is going to best suit that data before starting. And I think that's really been learned from my own lived experience on having to do multiple searches for review articles in my earlier research. I think another issue, which I think is really worth highlighting, is being very clear in the methods section when submitting an article to the Red Journal. The readers and reviewers really need to understand what's been done and being very explicit about your search strategy, where that's necessary, the inclusion criteria, the study quality. These make a huge difference in terms of how they're assessed at the outset. Also, there will be times when there may be justification for not exactly adhering to the recommendations we've made. There may be very good reasons why that wasn't done. And if that's the case, then the authors just need to be very transparent about why they've chosen to admit that particular element which we've considered in this article. So what I'd also recommend doing is submitting the relevant checklists for those types of reviews where they exist. For instance, the PRISMA statement checklist. I think this is really helpful to help tailor how the paper's written and make it much more clearer for editors and reviewers to streamline their assessments. We're all very busy. Doing these small things can really help the editors and reviewers who are generally interested in really trying to help these papers through to successful submission and publication. And these review articles are often quite long, up to 6,000 words. And what you really want to do is make this as easy as possible for the readers, for the editors, and for the reviewers. And I think submitting that as supplementary material, it's not compulsory, but it does really help streamline the assessments of these papers.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I love all the comments you're giving here, which are such a rich field of places where we all could learn more and improve. And I guess the other thing I would say is just on a more basic level, making the question distinct and interesting. I think that the one of the faults that I see cited a lot in reviews of reviews that we receive is that the question has already been done by other reviews, or the question isn't distinct and specific enough or interesting enough or add to practice or research enough to kind of justify the burden and the weight of these reviews. And as you say, that there just wasn't enough behind it, like it's not matched to the volume of evidence that exists or doesn't exist. So hoping that by this, again, not meaning to criticize, but just hoping that as a community, we can start to do really good work and help everyone advance. And I guess continuing on this, Dr. Smith and Dr. McDowell, since you've taken such a deep dive into our review history, were there any particular reviews that you came across during the research that you particularly liked and that you might recommend to our listeners? I know I have some of my own personal favorites, but I'll try to hold back.
That's what we found is that there are strong examples that exist in the Red Journal across every type, and there are a few that stood out for us. So the systematic review and meta-analysis by Dr. Razavian on IMRT for early stage glottic cancer was a great example of a review with very strong methodology and clinical value. For the critical reviews, the article evaluating the MDADI and HPV-associated oropharyngeal cancer by Dr. McDowell, we also found was a strong example of a critical review. Now, for scoping reviews, there was only one published, and this was by Dr. Marsaligo, but it was excellently conducted, and this was on mentorship initiatives. And we found this to be a great example of a scoping review. One example of a bibliometric review was a study by Agarwal in 2018, which undertook a global analysis of radiotherapy-related research across the globe, tracking time, leading countries, institutions, journals, and patterns of collaboration.
Dr. McDowell, any personal top hits from you?
No, I think, when we went through these ones, I think those were ones that really aligned with the methodology, but also, really touched on important clinical questions or research questions that are highly relevant to our field at the moment. I'd be very interested to hear like what your personal favorites have been, Dr. Yom, over the years, because I guess you have a more broader perspective on across some of the other tumor streams as well.
Well, I guess there was one that was written by Dr. Barker and Dr. Postow quite a while ago on radiation therapy and immunotherapy combinations for melanoma. And I remember that because it was very much a critical review, but at the time, and this is what I mean when I talk about timely questions or important questions. At the time, immunotherapy really wasn't sort of as established as it is now. And certainly combinations with radiation were a very, very novel question. And so these authors were writing about something that was really an educational need, and they did it as a critical or a narrative review, from what I recall. And I just remember at the time that it was incredibly read, like a lot of people were very interested in that article. And so that one sticks out to me. And it was when I was sort of earlier on and was just moving up the editorial hierarchy, so to speak, and was having more of a sense of what kind of articles were important for our mission. So that one, just the timing wise, I sort of remember that one. And it was, of course, very well written. The one I'm thinking of recently, I believe, was a scoping review. I think Dr. Golden actually wrote that. I think this one actually post-dated your research project because it was just published, but it was a scoping review on different methods of education of patients. And I thought that was a nice fit to a question also, just because, again, we very rarely see scoping reviews, but this one really does fit the question in a certain way because it was able to sort of categorize the different types of education that are out there and where the gaps exist. And I think that's actually a very good fit for that particular topic, which is still somewhat, I guess I would call, scattershot and a little nascent within the field of radiation oncology as far as a systematic approach to patient education. So it has a very unifying and systematizing sort of mission to it, which I think is good for a scoping review. And I just remember thinking at the time that that was a really clever fit for the topic, to go back to your point, Dr. McDowell. Can't think of any others at the moment, but there have been many very good critical reviews, systematic reviews. Obviously, if you look back at the Quantech and Pentech, which sort of styled themselves as systematic reviews, those have all been excellent. All the texts have always been excellent. And we've published just so many systematic reviews over the years that have been really, really high quality. It's almost probably our highest form in some ways of review article that we publish at the journal.
I think we are going to start seeing more scoping reviews. I think that type of review is becoming or embedding itself more into the scientific research in radiation oncology. And we published in the head and neck section recently a scoping review on thyroid cancer in the last few months. So if there's been others since our close 8 closeout date at the end of last year, it does seem that these are articles, these are review types, which we're going to be seeing more of.
I think one thing I would say also is that it seems like people are defaulting to the idea of a systematic review. And I've even seen this in some of the reviewer comments sometimes on the papers we receive, that the systematic review, because it feels more quantitative, has inherently more value than a critical or narrative review. But I would also say that some of the most interesting critical or narrative reviews we've had were the ones that really met a distinct, very unique educational need. And here I'm thinking of one that we published on pelvic radiation and how to design that in patients who are transfeminine. There's another one that was very distinctive, which was a primer on radiopharmaceutical therapy, almost like a guidebook sort of, but met a very needed gap, I think, in the field right now. And then the other one I was thinking about, of course, was the one that's been one of our highest read articles ever since we published it, which was a narrative review on designing treatments for osteoarthritis. And as we all know, that's a very evolving topic where there hasn't been a lot of very concrete guidance in the United States. So while that remains a controversial practice and topic, I think having an article that at least set out what the sort of state of knowledge was very, very important for people to just even to be able to understand the discussion and the debate around it. So those are some of the examples I would say where a critical review or a narrative framework really worked well to just sort of give that state of the art review and expert guidance in an area where there was just a basic need for learned synthesis of the evidence from persons who have taken a deep dive into the literature. So, a question for both of you, how did doing this research actually change your own idea about reviews? Do you feel differently reading or writing a review now?
Absolutely. This project has changed the way that I approach reviews quite substantially. So what stood out to most to me is that many reviews don't clearly state what type they are or follow the recommended methodology. So now when I'm reading a review, I look for a number of clues. So have the author stated what type of review this is? Is this systematic or narrative? Is there a search strategy? And is there a critical appraisal? And I think as well, when I'm writing reviews now, I'm much more intentional. So I start by defining the research question and then looking through the different review types that are available and trying to choose the best one that I think that will be able to answer the question.
I would agree with Dr. Smith. I think throughout this process of writing this article, it's really made me more deliberate in how I approach reviews, both as an author and as an editor. When I see a review now, I'm starting one of my own, the first questions I'm asking myself are, what are we really trying to achieve with this review article, and does the chosen review type and methodology support the goal of that specific question? And I've certainly started a few review articles myself with a less clear approach than that. And I think when you're reviewing these review articles or either as an editor or a reviewer, you can really get the sense from that by just reading the paper that maybe this article did start off with not a particularly clear question or approach. And I think so going through those kind of things at the start, I think that's really attuned me to how to get the most out of the methodologies that are at our disposal, and so that we can best synthesize what's out there.
Okay, and in the modern context, we all know that AI is very rapidly changing ways that we approach publishing and synthesis of the medical literature. Any thoughts, Dr. McDowell or Dr. Smith, about how AI could potentially change the writing or reading of reviews in the future?
So I guess the use of AI across our whole field is evolving. The use of generative AI to write critical or any types of review at this point in time, I guess, is a violation of ethical publishing at this point in time. I guess in terms of it being able to synthesize information very quickly and clearly, it does a very good job of what's already out there. But when you think about some of these, particularly the critical types of reviews, it's probably the human interpretation in taking that forward that I'm not sure we've seen how well AI will be able to move those forwards. It's really the human at this point and thinking that's probably that probably will surpass what AI is able to regurgitate from what's already been put out into the ether.
I do agree with that. I think there's something about having clinical experience, having actually known patients who experience this and who have gone through their whole natural history over the arc of the disease. I think that does add a certain depth of understanding and transcendence of the printed literature that I don't know that AI will be able to replicate easily or perhaps ever. Any thoughts on that, Dr. Smith? You're of the generation that will probably use AI quite a lot.
Yeah, so I agree as well that I think at the moment the AI is unable to be able to provide that expert level. It will be interesting to see full reviews in the future if it does evolve to be able to assist review articles in the manual extraction process and things of that nature.
I will say, I think there's room for very, very interesting publishing experiments as this technologies go forward. I could imagine, for example, living reviews where the database is sort of constantly updated, or I could also imagine AI being used almost as a producer of new hypotheses out of meta-analyses and this sort of thing that could lead to perhaps scoping or bibliometric types of syntheses. But I do think that at the end of the day, there has to be some sort of intelligent oversight of the process just to make sure that it's ethical and makes sense and isn't reproducing the biases that we know plagued so much of the literature, or worse yet, hallucinating. So remains to be seen how that will all sort of shake out in the wash and how reliable we really think those kind of reviews could become.
I agree, Dr. Yom. I think one of the most important things or take homes that you're going to get for review is understanding or knowing that information is reliable and accurate. And I think at this point in time, having those human checks and balances in place in the reviews is essential to drawing the conclusions together and also ensuring that the correct information has been used to draw those conclusions.
I still think, at least at this time, like you said, human oversight will be important to make sure that the meta-analysis is done properly, make sure that that expert view and synthesis and sort of overall understanding of the literature comes forward in the writing. I think that still remains to me very uniquely human. And what do you think is the place of review articles at the Red Journal? Are there certain types that we should be encouraging or trying to expand?
I see review articles as sort of central to the mission of the Red Journal. I think for many of our readers, a good review article is the entry point into what are sometimes very complex areas and areas where there's overwhelming amount of literature. And a well-crafted review can either be educational or also help clinicians calibrate their own practices. And it also helps researchers to see where those gaps are. And scoping reviews can be very helpful in identifying where those gaps might be to give new wave of researchers those ideas that they need. Radiation oncology is a rapidly evolving discipline. We're a very academic specialty and there's a high amount of output every year. And when we're in that kind of fortunate position, I think we do need that kind of synthesis as much as we need original research. This applies whether it's technology, biology, or clinical types of research. In terms of what we should be encouraging, I think any fit for purpose reviews can be helpful. I think at least in the head and neck section, we're very open to the full spectrum of review types, as long as they have a clear question and add something that's genuinely new or educational or informative for our readership. And I'm really hoping that this article sort of serves as a friendly roadmap for authors to help choose the right review for their question and avoid some of the common pitfalls before they submit their work to the Red Journal.
Dr. Smith, speaking as a registrar, someone still in training, what's helpful to you? What do you want to read?
So I agree with Dr. McDowell. I think that it's important to be flexible with what type of reviews I submit to the Red Journal, and things that novel or add to the literature, I think, would be things that I'd personally be interested in reading. I haven't, as you mentioned before as well, Dr. Yama, have enjoyed some of those other critical reviews that are in the more novel areas that otherwise are quite hard to be able to synthesize information on.
Great. Thank you so much for doing this research and for sharing your thoughts on it with us. An important part of the history of the Red Journal is that we regard the journal itself as an ongoing experiment and research endeavor. And I personally love it when we have authors who are willing to examine the journal's own knowledge gaps or our serendipitous successes. So it's always very interesting to me as we learn more about our journal and think about how it may or may not reflect the field of radiation oncology writ large. Thanks so much again, Dr. McDowell and Dr. Smith, for your time and insights today. And thanks for all your work on behalf of the journal.
So Dr. Yum, I'd really like to thank you for the invitation to present this work that we've done, reflecting on reviews and paving out a pathway for future reviews at the journal. And I'd like to thank Dr. Smith for really leading the charge on this research and for providing very interesting discussion for the listeners out there today. And just as well, I'd also like to thank the bigger group, including Dr. Dickstein and Dr. Mitter, who really contributed heavily to the formation of this article.
I'd like to echo those thoughts from Dr. McDowell. I'd like to thank the broader research team, so Dr. Scher, as well as Dr. Dickstein and Dr. Mitter, for all their hard work on this project. I'd also like to thank the Red Journal for allowing us the opportunity to better publish this important work and also to highlight it on this podcast.
Thanks again to both of you. Wonderful, and so appreciate this reference work that we can give to our authors, our reviewers, and our readers to understand reviews better at the Red Journal in the future. This has been a podcast from the Red Journal. The Red Journal is Astra's premier journal for original laboratory and clinical investigations related to radiation oncology, radiation biology, medical physics, and both education and health policy as they relate to the field. Happy 2026.